everyone. I hate to say it, but we're co-locating again. Most of us are up at Camp Quest Northwest, helping teach kids about science, evolution, and good old classic skepticism. We're also probably teaching about camping, but I don't even know how to do that without at least 12 Apollo space programs worth of laptop anymore, so I'm not going to be any help. For Camp Quest Northwest's first time out, Becky's some sort of camping overlord, and I'm teaching a segment about electromagnetic radiation. Big surprise, I'm doing a radio unit. We'll be back to our normal shenanigans soon enough. But that doesn't mean we're slacking off for the show this week. We've been preparing for this, and for this week, we've got a really fun interview. Jesse Baring is a frequent contributor to Scientific American, Slate, and has made numerous appearances on other media. Baring is the former director of the Institute of Cognition and Culture at Queen's University Belfast, and began his career as a psychology professor at the University of Arkansas. He is the author of The Belief Instinct, a book exploring the psychological and developmental aspects of religious belief. Last month, his book Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? And Other Reflections on Being Human hit the shelves. It's a collection of essays dealing with subjects including evolution, free will, human sexuality, paraphilia, and cannibalism. Since this interview, he's received some attention for his statements on Slate and Scientific American regarding the Chick-fil-A ridiculousness, and they are well worth a read. Join Becky and I as we spoke with Jesse last month while he was in Seattle for a book tour.
One of the things that we like to talk about on Ask an Atheist is to be a part of the atheism visibility movement means that there's a certain amount of science boosterism. I think a misapprehension about how the atheism community views the science process, because you were telling me that your background is in developmental psychology, but you've been classified as an evolutionary psychologist.
I think whenever you start making evolutionary interpretations of human behavior, people will see you as an evolutionary psychologist. I mean, I'm a developmental psychologist by training. My earlier research as a graduate student was in chimpanzee social behavior and cognition.
Oh, nice.
So I think there was this inherent evolutionary framework that we were working in. It was never sort of explicitly evolutionary psychology, I think, as most people use that phrase. And it's a very loaded phrase, I think, evolutionary psychology. I don't wave the banner of evolutionary psychology, but I think that there's a lot of work in the field that actually is very good. And not only intuitively persuasive, but empirically supported.
Sort of in psychology as a whole. In the atheism community, there's a tendency to view, you know, physics and mathematics and the real hard sciences, quote-unquote hard sciences, I actually kind of hate that phrase, as the things to pay attention to.
That's an interesting observation. I do think that from the dialogue that I've seen with sort of organized atheistic communities, it's much more focused on the hard sciences and you know, evolutionary biology, perhaps, but not a lot about human behavior, really, which is actually kind of counterintuitive. And I think that they, from the perspective of the evolutionary biologist, what we're doing is not proper sort of studies on reproductive fitness, because we are not actually tracking genetic success. There are other ways to investigate these questions, many don't find them terribly convincing.
There's sort of the draw towards, I guess, the downside of skepticism a little bit, is that there's a draw towards things that have already been well established through the scientific process, and that people in the atheism visibility movement seem to forget that in order to get to a theory, you first have to have a hypothesis, and that hypothesis must be tested. As you're out there in the, you know, as you're meeting atheists or people who are in the community, I mean, what do you see?
Yeah, I mean, as a general sort of popular science writer, I write about things that I find interesting. They don't have to, I mean, typically I write about things that have already gone through the filter of the peer review process and are in, you know, top tier journals and have been funded by external grants that don't have any particular agenda in the science community. But I'll also pay attention and I'll give air to things that, you know, maybe are completely crazy. You know, they're totally speculative, but I find them interesting.
Yeah.
And I think they're worthwhile discussing and talking about. And, you know, everything that I write that has a speculative type of bent to it, I give plenty of caveats that, you know, this requires further testing. But I think that people are uncomfortable oftentimes just discussing sort of openly different ways to investigate questions about human nature and human behavior. They just don't want to go there.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe I think that, I mean, from an atheistic perspective, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because, I mean, if anybody understands that we are simply animals, it's not like they're uncomfortable talking about us being animals. I think other communities, religious groups, you know, that's the sort of core problem that they have, that somehow discussing human nature from an evolutionary perspective reminds them that that they are simply animals. Atheists don't have that problem, but they don't like the empirical methodology that I think goes into psychology and studying human nature.
Now, my first questions were more about the research end of what you do, but right. as you pointed out, you also write popular books about psychology and evolution,
which
and stuff
is
like
pretty recent. I mean, I got my PhD in developmental psychology about 10 years ago in 2002, and I studied religion. I studied children's conceptions of different things. My dissertation was on how children think about the afterlife.
No kidding.
What happens to the mind after the body dies, basically. Mm. And we put on puppet shows where a character was killed, and we asked them questions. Okay, now that this character is dead, can he still taste things? Can he still smell? Is he still thinking about his mother? And we were trying to get at the psychological trajectory of thinking about these questions to begin with, outside of we didn't actually frame these things in terms of religion, so we didn't ask them questions about soul or anything like that.
Right.
It was simply, can you do this once you're dead? And the interesting thing was that the younger the kid, I mean, we're talking like 3 and 4 year olds here, the more likely they were to say that the mind survives biological death, which was kind of surprising in the sense that I think most people, if you ask them how children learn about the afterlife, they'll say, oh, they're taught this by their parents, they're indoctrinated by going to church, and they hear things on TV. But in fact, the older that children got, irrespective of the religious milieu that they were sort of growing up in, they were less likely to attribute psychological states to the dead.
Really?
Animal. There's a denominational difference. So the older you get, if you come from a very religious household, you still give these explanations about having these psychological abilities after you're dead. But if you come from an atheistic or scientific sort of household, then you're more likely to be a materialist. So it's not to say there aren't cultural effects and family influences right. and those types of things, but there's an infrastructure that, which is what I focused on, sort of what is the basic sort of starting point about how we think about these big existential questions like the afterlife, about God's mind, about meaning and purpose and fate, destiny. Really the best way to get at that, I think, is to study as young as possible, these children that haven't been adulterated yet by belief systems.
I'm finding this really interesting because it suggests that psychological understanding of death comes after sort of the internal formation of an afterlife concept. There's a common phrase in the atheism community that all babies are atheists.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a bit strong. I think it has rhetorical appeal.
It does.
It's like saying that you're born gay.
Right.
You know, I'm a gay scientist too. So I mean, that although it has this sort of rhetorical value to it in terms of just sort of communicating the message that it's society that's the problem and mm-hmm. those types of things, it's not quite that simple.
Sure.
There are developmental models. My own work, Justin Baird's work. He wrote a book called Born Believers, and he's actually a believer. I'm an atheist, but he's a believer.
Sure.
He actually thinks that the mind is prepared in children by God to sort of be receptive to these types of ideas. I think that we have these sort of natural, innate psychological components that make it very easy for us to think about the mind of the dead or God or meaning and signs and natural events and so on.
Sure.
It doesn't make it real. I think it's all an illusion, but nevertheless, that's what we're dealing with in terms of the natural building blocks. We're not just blank slates. I mean, I think that's, we're not just sort of absorbing all the information from being in a religious environment. It's operating on our minds that are sort of prepared to receive this information.
Where the evolutionary thing comes in is that we are social creatures, that we evolve to work in groups of people. So we sort of have some possible structural stuff in there to support social interaction and things like that.
I mean, I've never seen myself as, I think, there are definitely strong points to the sort of the atheistic movement and sort of these organized focus groups that sort of mm-hmm. are really genuinely trying to make sociocultural changes and increasing the visibility of atheists and so on, which I do think is important. However, I'm always wary of this sort of groupthink, this sort of communal mindset about what an atheist has to be. I never felt like I fit in very comfortably with the your sort of stereotypical atheist, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I wrote a piece for Salon a couple of weeks ago, actually, I didn't give it this title, but this is the editor of Salon, gave it the title Don't Trust the Godless.
That was actually one of the things I wanted to talk about, yeah.
But that wasn't my original title. I think, they were just doing that to sort of be provocative.
Of course. That's,
but the central argument remains the same, which is that all else being equal, if you have to make a decision to interact with somebody in terms of some implicit trust, do you go with somebody who is, you know, a certifiable believer, for all appearances are indicative that that person actually genuinely believes there's a God that will punish them, or somebody that you either don't know or is an avowed atheist or doesn't believe whatsoever. And I argued in this piece that from simply a social algorithm, you know, just from a heuristic perspective, it makes more sense to go with a person who believes genuinely that if they do something wrong, they're going to be punished by God. Of course, you know, there are all sorts of, you know, well, what if he's just faking it, or, you know, you don't know if he really does believe in God and so on. But, and of course, that's true. However, the critical line there is all else being equal.
That's sort of the key. I know in my case, I tend to avoid people who are overwhelmingly believers, even before I went on this crazy activism
nobody likes to be proselytized and all that stuff. But.
Because of stuff that happened in my past, you know, I have these experiences with religious people, you know, I tended to avoid them for a long time. Now, I want to engage with them, but for completely different reasons.
I kind of had a weird, you know, sort of, not weird, but, you know, a personal experience with when my mother was very sick, when she died about 12 years ago, she had a series of hospice caregivers, and they were incredibly, like, religious, spiritual women that, you know, these nurses that devoted all their time to dying patients. And not to say that atheists wouldn't do that, but right. I think that they had an agenda, but the agenda actually translated to genuine, sincere caring toward my dying mother. And I, you know, that was a very positive experience for me in terms of somebody that believed in God and that there was a heaven.
Right.
I couldn't tell my mother that there was a heaven because I didn't believe that, but they brought her comfort. I think that you need to pick your battles. I think that there's some situations where the strong rationalist argument isn't necessarily the best one to go with.
Do you think there's a way to approach the sick and the dying and to comfort them without suggesting that they're going to exist past, you know, there is an afterlife? Because one of the things we're doing is forming a statewide organization called the Evergreen State Freethought Federation. And one of the things that some of our members want to do is hospital visitation and do it from sort of a humanistic or a godless perspective. And that's one of the things that I wrestle with is, you know, it's real easy to come in and say, well, this suffering is going to happen, and at the end of the suffering, you're going to, you know, have cheesecake with Jesus. Right.
I think that it's like you have to, it depends on the fit between the message and the patient.
Okay.
So personally, I would value that. I would appreciate somebody having some sort of existentialist conversation with me about as I'm dying, and that, you know, we're simply, our psychological experiences are just these sort of ephemeral experiences in our minds. Our minds are going to stop and our brains stop working. And, you know, I would appreciate a conversation like that as I'm dying, I think. It would remind me of the bigger picture from my own personal philosophy. But a lot of people wouldn't. I mean, that's, you can't, I think it would be just as uncomfortable to sort of proselytize, even if we consider it to be humanistic, to somebody who doesn't, who is still sort of grappling with faith. And by the way, I should say, and I point this out actually in my first book, Belief Instinct, that it's interesting, sort of your deathbed conversions are often sort of capitalized on by very religious people saying, oh, look, you know, he does believe in God, and, you know, there really is a God. Obviously, he can change his mind at the very end. You know, a lot of the evangelicals try to do that with Darwin.
Oh, yeah.
But to me, that's complete, from a psychological perspective, it's completely irrelevant. Whether I change my mind at the last minute says absolutely nothing about the actual existence of God. I'll probably be delusional. That's not my sharpest time in terms of my sort of critical thinking abilities. So I never really understood that argument by the religious community that in the end you'll find out. You know, in the end everything will become clear to you, and you'll embrace God at the end. So that has absolutely no impact on the actual existence of God.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. We're Ask an Atheist. We're a show about atheists, and you identify as one in your books, and your first book was written the Belief Instinct.
Thank you.
What was your personal path to atheism? Have you always been an atheist? Did you start out in a believing community? Or
no, I mean, I was very fortunate in that my parents, I think, we had a very irreligious family. They weren't, you know, strong atheists or scientists or rationalists, but it just wasn't a priority in our household. My mother was Jewish. We, in principle, technically, we were supposed to be raised Jewish, but very rarely did we ever go to synagogue. We celebrated some of the high holidays, Passover, Hanukkah, but, you know, this was in the middle of Ohio, and it wasn't like a really big Jewish community there. My father was Lutheran, and there was a period of time, actually, that he was quite religious, and it was weird because he taught Sunday school to kids that were my age, and he would teach the kids in my class, you know, in Sunday school, but I wasn't going to these classes because I guess my parents had an implied agreement that we wouldn't be involved in the church. It would be a Jewish sort of childhood. But I think, you know, there was always that sort of obvious issue of, well, they can't both be right. I mean, he believes in Jesus being the Son of God, and she doesn't. And, you know, I think I just was more satisfied with the idea that it was they were both wrong. But I also remember, I mean, the few occasions where I was involved in some sort of religious ritual, you know, going to bar mitzvahs or, you know, celebrating. You know, occasionally we went to Christmas things at my dad's church. I remember feeling very uncomfortable socially in that type of environment. I thought the adults were acting very strange. I didn't understand how people that I interacted with normally started and had, you know, regular conversations with were gyrating and singing and not so much. This is Lutherans, but you know what I mean? They were, you know, they were chanting and it just seemed really weird to me that they were acting like this. And everybody was so sober and serious. And I felt always like an observer, I think, in that, in that sense, just finding it puzzling, that type of behavior.
This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. We're talking with Jesse Baring, author of The Belief Instinct, and Why is the Penis Shaped Like That?
Tacoma Telematics wants to help you connect with your clients. We can give you a top-notch web presence. Tacoma Telematics can take your website to the next level and make it an essential part of your business marketing, but that's not all. Want VoIP? We've got it, bringing large corporation phone systems capability at mom-and-pop prices. We build intuitive interfaces to help you manage your resources quickly and efficiently. Take advantage of our holistic approach to make your business communication succeed effortlessly. At Tacoma Telematics, we're committed to personal and professional integrity, open communication, and long-term relationships. See us at TacomaTelematics.com.
Billy! Billy, I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because it will explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
No human is burned with original sin, nor condemned to live in guilt, nor in need of salvation from the supernatural. I'm Eileen, Vice President of Humanists of Washington, a nonprofit organization dedicated to advancement through reason, science, and democracy. Our organization opposes the use of dogma in determining laws and strongly supports marriage equality in Washington. A full range of civil rights is necessary to achieve full personal empowerment in society. Get involved at humanistsofwashington.org.
Atheism TV. News, events, community, entertainment, debates, conferences. A massive repository of over 3,000 recent and fascinating atheist videos from all over the internet. Or watch The Infidel, our own regular news show. Visit the shopping area and buy something for that special atheist in your life. Or rent captivating shows, movies, and documentaries directly in your browser. Atheism TV, the world's best source of atheist videos. Visit atheismtv.com.
So you're on your Monday morning drive, and someone on Ask an Atheist says something that really, really gets your goat. You want to talk, you want to yell, you want to scream, and clicking the shiny red candy-like button just isn't good enough. Good! Call us! Leave us a message! Call Ask an Atheist at 206-420-0997 and vent your spleen now and for the future! That's 206-420-0997 and wait for the tone.
Doyle's Public House is Tacoma's number one spot for the best selection of import brews and Irish whiskey.
Football matches and Red Sox games, knowledge night and no cover live music.
Doyle's is your spot.
Check us out at doylespublichouse.com or stop by for a proper libation and soda bread at 2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma.
Like us on Facebook for all the latest updates and specials.
Doyle's in Tacoma.
2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma. doylespublichouse.com.
Welcome to Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. We're talking with Jesse Baring, experimental psychologist and author of The Belief Instinct and Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? But first, we need you to know that you can join the cast and crew on Friday, September 7th for an evening of smart and godless comedy. Jeremy Whitman, nationally touring comedian with the Mobile Asylum Tour and occasional host of Ask an Atheist, will be joined by Brad Upton, a past winner of the Las Vegas Comedy Festival. His album, Smart Guy, Stupid World, is available on iTunes. Again, that's Friday, September 7th at 7 p.m. at the Jewel Box Theater at 2322 2nd Avenue in Seattle. Seating is limited, so check out our website, askanatheist.tv, today. And now we return to the interview, where Becky is asking about Jesse Baring's most recent book and its compelling title.
So you have this very sexy, provocative book right now, and one of the chapters has to do...
Well, thank you.
Yes. One of the chapters has to do with bestiality or people being attracted to animals sexually. We've got this at Ask an Atheist a few times. I really want to know, why do you think there's some people that associate atheism with sexual attraction to animals?
A slippery slope sort of thing.
Yes, why? I mean, it's we're humans just like everyone else. We've seemed to get this thing saying, well...
I don't know. And I would be surprised if there was any meaningful correlation between the percentage of people who are certifiable zoophiles and atheists. There's no obvious connection between the two.
What do you think it is about people's assumptions about atheists that
bestiality and atheism and zoophilia? That's a good question. I mean, I think that maybe sort of underlying that is their uncomfortableness with the idea that we are animals to begin with, and atheists are sort of associated with evolutionary interpretations, and we think that we're animals, and therefore it's okay to have sex with other animals.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to put myself into their shoes and understand why they're thinking that way. But
that came with talking about evolution sort of in that context. So there's definitely that. Part of that we get as feedback, well, you're supporting gay marriage rights in Washington, so you must next want to support 4 people marrying their 5 yard animals and things like
that. Yeah, I mean this is an issue that I run into constantly, not bestiality and zoophilia alone, but just simply the issue of bringing controversial topics up and people misinterpreting that as an endorsement or somehow advocating people do that. As a psychologist, as a scientist, I'm simply asking the question of, I mean, there's no question that these people actually do exist.
I'm not taking
any sort of political stance in terms of saying that this is what we should be doing. I'm just saying, you know, I'm an existentialist more than I'm an atheist. I think I like to describe things the way that they are. I'm not trying to change things. I'm simply trying to be honest and paint a picture scientifically, narratively, of how people are behind the facade of the impressions that we're trying to make and the emotional residue that I think adults are thinking oftentimes. What are people like sort of at the core?
Definitely.
So you said you're more of an existentialist than you're an atheist. And I think that's a very interesting statement. But let me give you some background. Here on the show, I stick to what I call the two-word definition, which is no God. And that beyond atheism does not say anything beyond...
About meaning or
anything like that. Beyond the existence of gods. It seems that you might be suggesting that atheism is something more than no God. Are you talking from a social context or what do you mean?
Well, I've done a lot of research in cognitive science.
And, of course.
So meaning is really sort of central to the questions that I asked, that I've asked from my own research. I'm a huge fan of Jean-Paul Sartre and Camus. And I mean, I find much more of value in their interpretation of godlessness, their atheistic approach, than I do in a more hard-nosed Dawkins-like sort of religious people are absolutely stupid. Which, you know, it's irrelevant whether they are or not. Mm-hmm. I think the important thing to understand is that we all evolved the same basic neurological structure. We all have the same brain systems, assuming that we're not pathologically disturbed or have some sort of disorder,
Sure. Unless
you have autism or something like that. We all process social information the same way. And I think that we are all vulnerable, susceptible to seeing signs, to seeing messages, to seeing patterns in unexpected events and misfortunes. I think what makes the atheist different is that they recognize that as an illusion. And they reject their intuition.
Okay.
They don't entertain the truth value of what they're experiencing as actually being real outside of their heads.
Sure.
So, and that's why I say God is a cognitive illusion, because we all experience it. I think even an atheist experiences, unless they have Asperger's syndrome or they have autism and are have some sort of deficiency in social cognition and are not as hypervigilant to seeing meaning.
You kind of, I believe in the belief instinct, it was that
you sort of coalesce some of the writings of scientists and mathematicians that experience autism, and you talk about the different conception of God for someone who is autistic than for someone who is more typical in terms of their social behavior and engagement.
Right. And it really jumps out. I mean, I use Temple Grandin, a scientist, probably an ambassador for autism, extremely intelligent and high-functioning Asperger syndrome, and very scientifically minded, of course. And when she talks about her religion, she does consider herself to be quite religious, but her conception of God is very different than the conception of sort of your everyday person on the street, in the sense that she writes about God basically being particles interacting in the universe, sort of very physicalistic type of representation of God.
The mechanistic God.
Very
really.
Mechanistic. Yeah. And there are other mathematicians. There's another guy that I use in the book as well, talking about how he was always attracted to religion, and especially Catholicism, because of the rigid rituals that sort of go along with it, and just telling, you know, it helped him sort out what he was supposed to do in terms of appropriate social behavior by following the canon and the scripts and the rituals and in the church. But both he and Temple Grandin and some other high-functioning Asperger's individuals, if you look online, for example, at some of these listservs, when they talk about religion, it's a very different, it feels very different than people talking about God's, you know, personal interactions with them and having a meaningful relationship and caring what they do. So.
Some of the things that I saw in those descriptions from a more sort of scientific conception, saying this is all a sort of an organizing force and it's how particles interact with each other, and the more we look at our environment and our universe, we see these little interconnected fields and things like that. It was very reflective of a lot of the discussions of people that I now interact with who are atheists, and it's sort of reflective of a lot of their sort of transitional phase, if you will, between a general sort of believer, community-based churchgoer to sort of, oh, well, now I'm finding out all this scientific information and I'm trying to make it mesh.
Trying to synthesize the...
Yeah,
without
exactly.
becoming a full-blown atheist, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was reflective of sort of my teens and early 20s conception of, well, I'm trying to reconcile all this God stuff with what humans have discovered
about
their world.
Without abandoning God altogether.
Exactly.
I'm simply interested in the question of whether there's an intelligent God or an intentional God. For all we know, I mean, God, you know, there could have been some sort of intergalactic seahorse, you know, I talk about it in the belief instinct that dislodged a grain of sand in the cosmos, that everything that exists now is sort of a consequence of that. Or, you know, God sneezed or something and did everything accidentally, and this has sort of led to where we are now. But we don't need God to understand our human existence. We don't need God to understand our moral reality. We have trouble, I think, with the deistic questions, so the ultimate origins questions, or at least psychologists do. I mean, this is not, that's not a topic that psychologists are particularly interested in. You know, we leave that to the cosmologists and, you know, maybe some evolutionary biologists want to go there. But really, even the evolutionary biologists are talking about the origins of life, and they're talking from that point forward. Mm. I find it extraordinarily unlikely that there's a grand mind that is concerned with us of billions of species that have ever sort of been present on the Earth.
Nor at this point is it really a testable question. So
no, it's and it was never really an interesting question to me. I mean, the most interesting question to me is why people believe so strongly in the absence of evidence, I suppose.
Yeah. It seems like today, in just talking with us and in your initial research and in both your books, death is a really important sort of question for you personally that comes up, and you draw a lot on your experience with the death of your mother. Mm-hmm. And you even talk about a little bit how, even though your mother has passed, you know, she's dead now, mm-hmm. that you still sort of like have these little, you know, these little pangs of, oh, here she is, she might be, but I know that's not true.
Yeah, I don't trust even my intuition. I mean, I'll have, you know, I can give you some concrete examples. For example, I mean, I remember on, you know, maybe like the 5-year anniversary of her death or something, a picture that that I had that I knew that she hated crashed to the ground and broke in, you know, a million pieces. And my first impulse was to think, oh, she's telling me that, you know, she's giving me a message, something about this picture, or, you know, trying to communicate with me. But then I rejected that. You know, that's, I don't believe that to be the case, but nevertheless, I had that psychological experience that somehow she's trying to communicate with me.
So how do you think we can sort of help people to understand that those initial sort of illusions are really just illusions and part of our nature to like seek patterns?
I think that's very difficult, because I think people like to trust their gut. I mean, mean, people, they don't like to put in the effort in terms of some sort of laborious understanding of the psychology that sort of leads them or directs them to the conclusion that somehow this is just an illusion, that this is not actually, this does not have any truth value, this is just sort of how you were designed to think. People just like to believe what they feel.
It's not very comforting to think that.
It's not comforting,
no. It's uncomfortable.
It's not comforting, but I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's weird as an atheist, I think, because you can't believe that first gut impulse sort of response. You don't allow yourself to entertain that. I don't know. I mean, I think that it's always going to be an effort. I think that atheism is cognitively effortful. It is not as psychologically seductive, intuitive, natural right. as believing. And it's something that we are never going to find in the majority of the species.
Leads me to an interesting question. This is another thing, another thread throughout the atheism visibility movement is the anti-theism aspect of it. And to give you some background on Ask an Atheist is one of the things that we're really pushing right, and we talk a lot about right now, is how, let's take Catholicism, for example, is that there's this huge child rape thing going on within the Vatican.
It's still going on?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, actually, because there are lots of other denominations that you don't hear so much about the child molestation, but like even in Orthodox Judaism in Manhattan, there was a big child molestation case as well. It's interesting that certain denominations are kind
certain
of...
Certain denominations. I read something, I cannot remember where I read it, that, and you talk about this in, I believe, your new book, is how the word pedophile has become this huge thing that actually has several different psychological categorizations, that the reason why this happens in the Catholic Church is because they're celibate and they enter into seminary as teenagers, that they become sort of locked in that teenager mindset.
Yeah, I think the clergy has always been a haven for people that had sexual
right.
dysfunctions. And it was attractive, obviously, for homosexual men that couldn't come out of the closet, that weren't comfortable with it. The relationship between pedophilia, I suppose, you know, I think the common sense view is that they're molesting children as surrogates for actual adult partners.
Right.
But it's important from a psychological perspective to understand that not everybody who molests a child is a genuine pedophile. There are pedophiles who are, you know, diagnosably, if you put them in physiological testing environments, show a strong preference for children or prepubescence. There are other people who molest children that are more attracted genuinely to adults, but nevertheless, they use children as, you know, as surrogates or as, you know, they're drunk or they're on drugs or, you know, some horrible reason like that. So it's unclear the percentage of genuine pedophiles in the Catholic Church, for example.
And then some people are going to ask us, why make these delineations? Why not put them all in a box that says predator and be done with them?
I think they are all predators.
Right.
Well, I mean, anybody who molests a child is a predator, especially if you find the sort of strategic courtship and, you know, sort of the Jerry Sandusky type
right,
of thing.
Right, right.
But it's important to understand and to discriminate between sort of the subtypes because, first of all, if they are a genuine sort of certifiable pedophile, they're at increased risk of recidivism for committing that crime again. And it also helps with treatment and sort of risk prevention. And you have to understand sort of the nature of the problem that you're dealing with.
If we want to get people to stop, we have to understand the processes under which they go.
And you mentioned, I mean, there are, so the chapter you're talking about, there are several, I mean, I think in common parlance and colloquially, we talk about anybody being attracted to anybody under the age of, you know, 18 or whatever, being a pedophile. But in fact, sexologists and psychiatrists are finding that there are pretty discrete categories of erotic age attractions. Mm-hmm. There are people who are predominantly attracted to prepubescence. There are people who are predominantly attracted to the sort of pubescent age, like the Lolita type category.
Right, right.
There are the ephebophiles, slightly older adolescents. There are the teleophiles, the gerontophiles attracted to the elderly. So, I mean, it really sort of runs the broad spectrum of being attracted to particular age physical characteristics that signal age. It's a male thing. All these paraphilias are, I feel like I'm talking about actually my next book now, but the paraphilias are predominantly a male phenomenon.
Being a high school teacher in the state of Washington,
yes.
I come up against a lot of evidence that says it's not necessarily just a male thing, just based on the number of female school teachers in the state of Washington who are engaging in sexual behaviors with middle school
but
and high school
I wouldn't
boys.
Necessarily I don't know these particular cases, but I wouldn't necessarily assume that they are pedophiles, for example, or hebephiles or whatever. It depends on the age of the student, the physical characteristics of the student.
Sure.
The paraphilia is somebody who has a genuine paraphilia can only get aroused by a very specific target, or not just whether it's animals or kids or whatever.
The bottom line about dividing up all of the different kinds of paraphilias is not to excuse or celebrate any of these kinds of behaviors. It's to say, hey, what are the different approaches?
Diversity, that's for sure.
It's not a matter of the celebrating diversity. It's a matter of really targeting, saying, how do we fix this? How do we prevent this from happening? How do we prevent people from being harmed?
Yeah, you've got to be knowledgeable about the problems that I mean, how do you fix problems that you don't understand? It just seems pretty obvious to me.
This actually all sprung out of a question I was asking. Is one of the things is that Catholics and Jews have this Bible.
Oh, we were talking about molesting priests.
That's how we got here. That condones rape, torture, slavery, all these things. But no modern practitioner of these religions practice what this Bible says. So our stance on this is that individual believers are better than their religion. But that leads us to this position of being, well, anti-theist. And I guess the heart of this question is, do you consider yourself an anti-theist in that respect? And I'm sensing a no.
Not really. I mean, I don't have strong views about this. I mean, I find conversations with very religious, spiritual people inherently aversive, I suppose, and not very enjoyable. But I don't feel a need to... First of all, I've given up the possibility that somehow I'm going to convince them to see things from my point of view.
Sure, yeah.
So it just seems kind of a lost cause in that sense. No, I'm not an anti-theist. As a psychologist, I look at these people, and as atheists too, for that matter, as specimens.
Okay.
That, you know, they have these sort of interesting psychological profiles, and I want to understand why they think that way.
Sure.
I'm not here to fix people or convert them to atheism or whatever. I just find it an interesting phenomenon.
Okay. You know, we talk about atheism on the show, but we've never considered ourselves an evangelical show. We're not out to make atheists. We're out to explain the atheist position and why we don't actually deserve to be hit with rocks.
Yes, that's good. I was hit by a hot dog when somebody screaming anti-gay epithets at me.
No kidding.
And that person is probably religious.
Throwing a hot dog.
Yeah.
Are you sure it wasn't a kosher dig or something like that?
I don't think so. No, this was in Belfast, and my partner and I were sort of walking along in the park, and I don't think that we're especially stereotypical, but apparently we gave away our sexual orientation, and they started throwing hot dogs at us. They were having a barbecue or something, and talking about going to the bathhouses, or, you know, some nasty.
Trying not to think about the image throwing hot dogs.
Yeah.
You had to reach for a hot dog. Anyway.
But I should say, I mean, the whole gay thing, I think, has probably contributed to my distancing from religious social organizations. And, you know, I think that was always, I always felt uncomfortable because I was gay with people who saw that as just being inherently bad.
We recently did a fundraiser for Referendum 74 in Washington.
It was a piece of legislation that was passed by our state legislature, ratified by our governor, but there were enough people that gathered enough signatures to say, oh, we don't want it to just, you know, we're not content to let it rest as a law. We want to put it to a public vote. For marriage equality.
We decided that if it hit that stage, if it was put on the ballot, we would do a fundraiser. But we were getting people who were saying that we're creating a schism in the atheism movement by talking about gay rights all the time, and that this long conversation is something I did where I said, for the next 6 months, I want to hear non-religious reasons to be against marriage equality. Somebody give me a good secular reason why this is bad.
I haven't seen any.
Yeah. And since you're so interested in religion, from an atheistic perspective, you haven't heard any of these good reasons?
No, I mean, I've heard them, and perhaps I'm biased because they just they don't seem terribly convincing to me. But I think today, in contemporary sort of discussions about homosexuality, the religious thing is a central part of it. However, historically, you know, looking at the psychiatric view of homosexuality, there was no real religious stigma. It was a medicalization of homosexuality. A lot of these people were probably atheists themselves, you know, doing shock treatments of, you know, trying to cure people of being gay.
That was the DSM-3. It was still a...
I mean, when the first DSM, homosexuals were considered sociopaths, genuine sociopaths. I like to think that I'm actually quite nice, but that's how they're... And then it was more of a sexual dysfunction where it was just obvious that you needed to change somebody to be straight because that's what people were supposed to be. It wasn't really about God. It wasn't about marriage. It was all about just righting some a sickness, an illness.
Sure.
But today it's very different because, you know, the psychiatric community has rejected the medicalization of homosexuality and they don't consider it a disorder anymore. And really the only, so they can't lean on the psychiatric establishment for their cause. It all has to come from the sort of religious perspective now in terms of any argument against same-sex marriage or gay rights.
This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. In a moment, we'll ask Jesse Baring, author of The Belief Instinct and Why is the Penis Shaped Like That and Other Reflections on Being Human, about some of the academic feuds within the atheism visibility movement.
Looking to sell or buy a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, and surrounding areas? Plant your roots and invest in this entrepreneur-friendly area with world-class education and healthcare. Demand a professional and call Dawn Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 and let him work with you to achieve your goals, save your time, and protect your investment. Contact Dawn Summers of Professional Realty Group at dndrealty.ca. It's time you hired a professional.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the third Thursday meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
How do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
If you enjoy the programming we create on Ask an Atheist, please make a contribution with us. Your sponsorship keeps our show in the air and improves the quality of our broadcasts. Don't make us beg. Please go to askanatheist.tv and contribute today.
Doyle's Public House is Tacoma's number one spot for the best selection of import brews and Irish whiskey.
Football matches and Red Sox games, knowledge night and no cover live music.
Doyle's is your spot.
Check us out at doylespublichouse.com or stop by for a proper libation and soda bread at 2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma.
Like us on Facebook for all the latest updates and specials.
Doyle's in Tacoma.
2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma. doylespublichouse.com.
Stop throwing money away.
Shop with NetPro Ink and Toner and save up to 60% off your printing cost. All of our compatible cartridges have a 100% full year quality guarantee. Visit us at www.netprotx.com. That's NetProtx.com.
I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because it will explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
You're listening to Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. And yes, that is our voicemail number. Before we return to our interview with author and research psychologist Jesse Baring, we'd like to thank the folks who answered Peggy's challenge this week. If you weren't aware, this was a challenge issued to listeners of Ask an Atheist by Peggy from Kent to help support the show and to help get the message of the atheism visibility movement out to the mass media. Every dollar sent to Ask an Atheist goes directly to show production costs. This week, we'd like to thank Jeffrey from South Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Eric from Everett, Washington. If you'd like to answer Peggy's challenge and help keep Ask an Atheist on the air, please go to our website and click on the PayPal link today. I'd also like to thank everyone who answered my moral quandary about my furtive religious propaganda collection, and I promise we'll get to those emails in a later show. Preferably on a week when I'm not also teaching children about the wonders of the electromagnetic spectrum at the inaugural Camp Quest Northwest. And since Mike's not here, I'll just go ahead and mention Magneto right now. This should also serve as a reminder that this week, there's no post-show. We now return to our interview with research psychologist and author Jesse Baring, where Becky is asking about his approach to writing science for a general audience and his appearance on Morgan Freeman's Through the Wormhole, which was in the future at the time, but is now in the past, in true fake wormhole style. I also ask him about the atheism visibility movement's odd relationship with evolutionary psychology and psychology in general.
I found both the books eminently consumable, and one of the things that I was thinking is that it's a really nice sort of introduction for maybe not the strongest, most intellectual reader to
I write it for. You know, I when I envision the average reader, I picture myself as like a 19 or 20 year old, you know, having a conversation with myself and what I wish I had known at that time.
Right.
When I'm sort of exploring these, what I, you know, have learned since that period of time. So people who are not, you know, necessarily don't have very rich backgrounds in science, who might not even be attracted to scientific questions, but find themselves interested nevertheless. Or just, you know, people like my dad, you know, he's a glue salesman, but he's very intelligent. He's just not, he doesn't read Scientific American normally, but he's interested in human behavior. You know, if it's in front of him, he'll read it.
Yeah. And so it's kind of funny is that I hear when books like these get released, when they talk about psychology and current thinking in the psychology field, it's like, oh, it's just this mindless pat, blah, 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 blah. But where would we be in the atheism visibility
movement?
Well,
there's plenty of that, actually.
There's a lot, but when you
especially
have somebody
in the self-help section,
kidding. But then you also have, you know, Deepak Chopra, and on the physics side, you also have people like Michio Kaku, and while he might be a physicist, writes weird crap every now and again. And I find there's this weird schism about the idea of about science popularization out there, where they think science popularization waters down science and makes it and turns it into something else. On the other hand, where would the atheism visibility movement be?
They wouldn't be exposed to it if it wasn't popularized.
Exactly. I mean, without the, you know,
who has time to read all these technical journals and, you know, specialize in a particular field and really get to the meat of these questions? You know, they've got other things going on in their lives. They can't just, you know.
Was this the draw that brought you to writing? Was this what brought you to?
Well, I got burnt out from sort of traditional academia. Actually, I mean, I did the research and children's beliefs about religion and chimpanzee psychology, and it was very interesting, and I had a good time, and I learned a lot. But I kind of answered those questions to my own personal satisfaction.
Yeah.
Maybe I didn't answer everybody else's questions, but for me, I kind of arrived at the point that I wanted to, and I didn't want to spend the next 30 years just doing small iterations of the same psychology experiments to get to, you know, find and finer grained analyses of the same basic conclusion that I had already reached.
Sure.
Maybe I changed my mind, but also I just kind of got burnt out, and I started writing for Scientific American, and I enjoyed, you know, a little bit more playful style, I suppose. I didn't feel tethered to citations, and you know, everything had to be worded in a very formulaic way with academic journals. I liked the freedom of, you know, writing with my own voice and not just being a robot, sort of.
It actually frightens me how much people really wish this kind of stuff that we did were more like peer-reviewed academic journals. It's like, that's not what we're doing. We're not doing research. We're trying to be entertaining. We're trying to give people their own voice.
There's plenty of, I mean, go read the actual
journals. Absolutely.
Like, by all means, please do that. I think it's important to do that if you have questions after reading the summaries or the popular versions, to continue the work on your own.
Yeah.
But you've got to, you know, you've got to, for me, the trick is making it engaging, you know, it's making people actually interested enough to learn the material. You know, sometimes you have to be a little inappropriate to do that, just to kind of get people. I mean, I get some people riled up, I suppose, with some of the topics I talk about. I don't do that intentionally. There's nothing sort of fabricated in my style or my voice. I'm not just trying to be provocative because I like to make people upset. I really do feel this way when I make these points and make these arguments. And But I think it's, but I think even if they get upset, they're talking about it still, you know,
right,
they wouldn't have heard of it if they, you know, they, and I think the sort of emotions, once they kind of die down a little bit, they think about it a little bit more critically, and maybe I'll learn something from the conversation too. You know, I'm learning along the way too when I'm writing, you know, a lot, I'm not an expert in most of these things that I'm writing about. These are, you know, questions that I have. I go into the literature, I do the research, and
I
translate it.
I can really speak to that. I've learned so much just in the 2 years and change we've been doing this show, just because if I'm going to talk about it in front of people, I should know what the heck I'm talking about.
Legwork, yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of the popularization of science, you were recently on Morgan Freeman's Through the Wormhole show, were you?
Oh, it hasn't. Yeah, they filmed it. It hasn't aired yet. It's, okay. I think it's August 10th is the air date.
Why were you on the show? What was it like?
There was a segment of the show that was sort of built around the arguments that I make in The Belief Instinct.
Okay.
And they filmed some experiments that I've run with children.
Okay.
So they went to, we set up sort of a makeshift lab in the local college and recreated some of the afterlife studies with children. Actually, no, we didn't do the afterlife studies. We had a study where we put children in a room and told them that there was an invisible woman in the room with them. And we wanted to see how that it would influence or affect their behavior.
Wow.
Because the argument is that if the kid thinks that they're alone, they're going to cheat on a really tempting sort of competitive task,
right,
versus those kids who think that there's an invisible woman sitting in a chair watching them. And so they filmed that, and another experiment too. It should be interesting.
Cool.
Looking forward to seeing that.
I'm honestly not all that familiar with the show. Have you guys, has anybody?
I'm not either, to be honest.
I haven't seen it. I've heard that it's a really nice, accessible introduction for a lot of people.
It's Morgan Freeman narrating. I mean, he's the voice
of
God.
He did well with
right?
Godwin, so.
Is it really like hanging out with God?
I'm just grateful to have Morgan Freeman actually say my name out loud. That's pretty cool.
That's
an experience. So.
Yeah.
Maybe we can aspire to such things.
I need to like get it on my voicemail or something.
Very cool. I guess we can bury the hatchet on this. You're known for having a feud with known atheist and anti-theist P.Z. Myers.
I am?
Yeah. Well,
who? I'm not familiar with that name.
Okay. Then we don't have to bury the hatchet on this one. But you said it's an extension of a feud in academia between...
Yeah, no, I'm not entirely sure where he's coming from a lot of times. I think there's this sort of, among a lot of evolutionary biologists, not just P.Z. Myers, but people like Jerry Coyne, for example.
Yeah.
Have a very negative view of evolutionary psychology. And, you know, perhaps there are bad evolutionary psychology experiments, but there are lots of good ones too. And I think that there is, I don't know if it's sort of an internecine sort of conflict between the different disciplines. This is, you know, but that's my sense that they view it as sort of their territory when we're talking about evolution and human beings. So to think about the evolution of neurological systems, the brain producing psychological or cognitive heuristics that are also adaptive, not just, you know, anatomical body parts, they're not comfortable with that.
That seems a bit weird. It seems like once we have,
they'll say they're comfortable with it, but that's simply not, that's not true.
But they want to look at it from like a perspective of just gross anatomy or?
Well, that's certainly the emphasis.
Okay.
The emphasis is on, non-ethereal mind that, you know, they want concrete, physicalistic types of, things that they can put under the microscope or measure objectively. Objectively, it's sort of in their model.
Right.
You know, I do think they have, I mean, of course we can't go back 100, 200,000 years into the past and find out what our ancestors were doing and, really confirm these hypotheses. However, there's reverse engineering. I mean, that's the nature of,
That's exactly it. Is as somebody who's not connected to this field whatsoever and is not an expert, it just seems like that if we have vestigial structures in our body,
structure function relationship,
and a structure function relationship socially or that neurologically we'd have those structures as well. And once we became social creatures, there might be some social structures like that or neurological and, you know, neuropsychological things there that we could look at.
And there's no question that there is. I mean, cognitive neuroscience is all about identifying, you know, specifically designed parts of the brain that do very specific functions.
Yeah.
And so interpreting those functions within an evolutionary framework, I think, is very valuable. It's important to understand why they work the way that they do. But, you know, I'm not sure that we'll ever sort of reconcile those two fields.
I guess on that particular argument, I've always been more on the, I think psychology is important, and I think it's, you know, I don't get the view that a lot of people have.
I don't understand the hostility, to be honest.
I mean, I don't. I think it's because it's a new science. I mean, anthropology's got a few hundred years. Astronomy has had a couple thousand years and started out in astrology. Psychology is what, 150, 200 years old, really? I mean, from a scientific perspective, I just, maybe they don't like the new.
Well, I think, I think it also has to do with people's folk conceptions of determinism and our ability to make informed decisions about moral issues, and this incorrect view, this erroneous view that we, if we are evolved to, you know, think and process information in a certain way and to behave in a particular pattern, that we have no control over it. And I actually do think we have less control over our behavior than we like to think.
Right.
However, we're very complex organisms that have caught into systems that can also evaluate our intuitions and why we're thinking the way that we're thinking and change the course of our behavioral decision making. So it's not inevitable just because, you know, we're arguing that these are evolved psychological adaptations that they will lead to a particular outcome.
Right, right. Sort of like the thing Sam Harris said recently about free will, about he doesn't really believe in it because we arise from deterministic processes. So we must therefore be deterministic.
Yeah, I think if you look deeply enough, everything is determined.
Yeah.
And I mean, even our ability to even consider these types of questions and to weigh these complex issues, we have to be bright enough, you know, have the intelligence basically to look at these questions properly and our intelligence is a product of our developmental experiences, our genetic heritage, our particular physiology at this particular moment and what we're thinking about. I mean, so everything is.
Yeah. Well, that leads to a weird question that suggests that the hostility towards, it's sort of inherent that the hostility that the atheism visibility movement feels towards psychology might be inherited from religious communities, because
I don't think that there's a hostility towards psychology. I think it's a hostility toward evolutionary psychology in particular.
Really? Okay. Yeah. I've seen some hostility towards the concept of psychology completely. I just thought the whole idea. It's very weird.
I think that perspective is just very easy to dismiss as just completely naive and not understanding the nature of psychology as a science. I think there's a particular distaste for evolutionary psychologists among a lot of atheists.
Yeah. Yes. Jesse Baring is the author of The Belief Instinct and the book just recently released, Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? His background is in developmental psychology, and he is known as an evolutionary psychologist. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Jesse.
And that's our time for the week. My name is Sam Olvey, and with me today was Rebecca Friedman. Thank you very much to our special guest, Jesse Baring. As usual, our music is by Chris Coleman. There is no post show this week. This show is pre-recorded. Ask an Atheist is an NEDM media production. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv or email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. Leave us a voicemail at 206-420-0997. Again, no post show this week. Talk to you next week.